Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
This episode is brought in part to you by Audible, your go-to destination for thrilling audio entertainment. Whether you're looking for a hair-raising experience to enjoy while you're on the move or eager to dive into sinister and shocking tales, Audible has an exclusive collection of thrillers from best-selling authors that will keep you on the edge of your seat. Like James Patterson's first audio-only thriller, The Coldest Case. Experience stories like never before, where every chilling detail is brought to life by captivating sound design. Plus, as an Audible member, choose one title a month to make yours forever. And now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Just visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
Welcome to Nerdist Podcast number 700.
Whoa.
That's
So this is it, right? We made it to the goal.
No, that was not. We're going to keep making more.
Kyle. Kept putting that X marks about 700. After that 701, the portal opens.
I never actually said that.
I could have sworn you were like, we got this portal, the demons come out.
No, you don't pay attention.
It's weird, the logo to the podcast.
Well, you pay attention to fake things.
Demon portal?
No,
right.
There's no demon portal. Nothing? We're going to continue to make shows after 700.
It's like when you dream that you already like did your chores, and then you wake up and you realize it was a dream.
But then you still have to do your chores. Do them,
it's like this.
Yeah.
I guess we're all going to live.
Hey, guess what? We have finally announced the other guests for the second Nerdist Podcast Live at San Diego. So, first Nerdist Podcast Live, Saturday, July 11th. Is Peter Capaldi and Sir Ben Kingsley. That's the early show, the 7:30 show. And the 10 o'clock show, Maisie Williams from Game of Thrones, Tom Hiddleston from Tom Hiddleston, and Guillermo del Toro. So it's going to be pretty amazing.
Now I'm jealous.
Yeah.
He's the greatest.
Guillermo is amazing.
He's my favorite person.
But Hiddleston's pretty great, too. And so that's that's our second show. So Maisie, Hiddleston, and
you guys
Guillermo.
Are just doing a live fan fiction. This is just...
It is like live fan fiction. Yeah. It is like live fan fiction. We're mashing up Guillermo and Game of Thrones and because Guillermo directed Crimson Peak, which Hiddleston is in.
Oh,
looks fucking awesome.
Super good.
And so that's it. Go to funcomfortabletour.com or ticketmaster.com to get tickets.
There's a chance that somewhere backstage, Guillermo del Toro is going to call Doctor Who a cocksucker. And that's a beautiful thing.
You think that's going to happen?
Oh, for sure. That's his just pronoun for people.
But it's
cocksucker over here.
It's loving.
Yeah. Travels across the universe. It's the greatest. I love Gilmore.
What else you got on the nurse community?
I have the most specific thing we've ever gotten, and I love this man's plight. This is from a man named John Parrott, who was sent in, and he is basically crowdsourcing the Nerdist audience right now. Chris, do you remember a show hosted by Leonard Nimoy in the 80s called Stand By, Lights, Camera, Action?
I remember In Search Of.
This is a different thing, because this was Leonard Nimoy hosted an anthology show, and this guy is trying to find, it's an episode, and he's describing it. They were all short films on this show that Leonard Nimoy was the host for. He needs to know what the name of this was and where he can find it on the internet. So are we ready, Nerdist Podcast?
Here we go.
It was a short film about a small box-like robot servant whose owner became increasingly dependent on it. The owner's friend, who was worried he was going too far, took the servant away to show him how bad it gotten, but then himself got dependent on the robot servant, who in the end told him to calm down and dispensed him a cigarette to calm him down. It was a real dark Twilight Zone-y kind of thing about how dependent we've become on technology. He pointed out that it's really like kind of exactly how we are today with our phones and all that kind of stuff.
So if people know, where can they reach out to
him? Okay, so this is where it gets real fucked up, because this guy didn't have the audacity to fucking get a Twitter or a Facebook account, but he has a LiveJournal account because it's 2002. So John, I'm going to shame you right now because I'm being real specific for this, but fucking get on it. Be a person. His LiveJournal account is cow-boy-holsler, holsler.livejournal.com. So if we could do a combination of A, find out what this is, because now I want to know as well, and B, give him a little bit of shit for only having a LiveJournal and tell him to get a Twitter account.
Yeah.
These people.
Okay, great. Katie, you got something real fast?
Yeah, I want to remind people at Comic-Con, we're doing a bunch of cool stuff with the podcast. We have the Podcast Network panel on Friday at 4:30 at the Horton Grand Theater. And right before that is a live Bizarre Stage with Jessica Chobot and Andrew Bowser. And on the panel is Pete Holmes, Kumail Nanjiani, Emily Gordon, Gil, 12-year-old Gil, Sandra Doherty, Matt Myra, and then it's hosted by Jonah. And tickets are kind of confusing for it. Like, you have to go to the Sales Pavilion, which is part of the convention center, at 9 a.m. and enter this lottery. But if you just show up, you'll probably get in.
All right, good to know.
Try to get tickets, but then just show up. And
oh, my God. I'm just bracing for Comic-Con.
You're
going to
die. Do you remember last year? How much you were like, man, I really scaled it back and it was great.
Yeah, I didn't. And by scaling it back last year, I only did like 8 panels. I grew to 12 this year.
Jesus Christ.
12 panels.
You're going to be bleeding from
your
eyes.
2 live podcasts, 1 live comedy show.
He's going to have no voice.
Your hour is just you sobbing.
There's like weird press in between. And then we have the Nerdist. We have the Nerdist Carnival there, which is basically our big thing at Petco Park, which we did in co-production with Geek and Sundry with Felicia Day and Amy Poehler, Smart Girls. And so it's this bit, there's like laser tag and jousting and games and photo booths and all sorts of weird. We're doing a big party the Friday night. So it's going to be really, like, Lydia was going to go to Comic-Con and finally I was like, I don't think you should go to Comic-Con.
You'll be alone the whole time. She'll never see you.
I don't think you're going to, I will never see you. I'll just be working. That's a brutal schedule, yeah, to just do it someone.
I can't fathom that. Yeah. That's
so
madman.
I would like, now you may not necessarily know Scott Weinger's name if I just said it, but if you see Scott Weinger, go, oh, that guy. Scott has been a friend of mine forever. He is one of the dearest, sweetest, funniest. I love him to death. I absolutely love Scott Weinger to death. Scott Weinger I knew in the old drinking days.
Yeah.
And Scott is the voice of Aladdin.
Fucking Aladdin.
It's the voice of Aladdin. And he was also on Full House a bunch. And I met him through Saget.
Steve.
And that's how we became friends. And then he became a writer. He's a super smart guy. Went
Black-ish.
To Harvard. He's a Harvard boy. But a wonderful guy. And just someone that I'm really good friends with that I adore. So I wanted to have him on. And he was great. And it is, you do, his voice is Aladdin's voice.
Yeah.
So it's not like he affects his voice to become Aladdin.
So we're just interviewing Aladdin.
So it sounds like the whole time you could just picture Aladdin. But it is, if you're not used to it, you're like, that's weird. Aladdin is has a wife and kids.
His life. I mean, that was just a fun part of his, you know, late teens. But he's got to move on.
Yeah.
He can't be a prince forever.
Yeah.
I mean, can be a prince forever.
After that whole 40 Thieves debacle.
You can.
Weird.
Well, eventually you might be king, yeah, if the king dies.
Well, yeah.
But I guess if you die that first, then ultimately works. You're prince forever. Here's the Nerdist Podcast number 700 with Scott Weinger.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
We used to hang with some regularity, but it was a long time ago now.
It was a really long time ago.
But
Katie's already recording, by the way, and you can say whatever you want. Scott Weinger.
Hi, Chris.
It's amazing that you're finally on the podcast.
You have no idea how excited I am. I'm a huge fan.
You're ridiculous. Scotty and I were part of the the Saget cleanup crew.
Yeah,
of
really
the
what was the pub in Westwood? Was that the place you guys?
Madison's.
Went? Yeah. Madison's, and we used to go to Q's a lot.
We used to go to Q's in West LA.
I guess that's, Bob lives near all those places, so that's why.
Yeah, he's a West Sider, yeah. And I was a West Sider at the time.
Yeah, back then you lived in Westwood.
Yes,
I was at
which
your apartment.
Which was very sad for a 30-year-old.
So, but you know, it was cool. You had all those. All those like butterflies and stuff.
Still got them.
Yeah, so cool. I went into your place. Because we used to just go out drinking a lot, and like, I went to your place. I was like, oh, there's a whole side of Chris I don't know about. Like,
yeah.
He's a secret taxidermist.
Secret taxidermist. Which, by the way, the collection has grown.
I gotta see it.
So now it's because you don't.
We're neighbors now, so I got to come over and see
you. Do you still live in that house right down the hill?
No, I moved.
But
just around the corner.
Right.
Same neighbor. It's like our third house in the same.
So not only did I know you separately, but then your wife, Rena, wrote on the sitcom that I did in 1998.
Yeah. What was it? It was Guys Like Us.
Guys Like Us. Yeah, yeah. Rena Mahmood.
She loves you. Huge fan.
She's great.
She's a huge fan.
And so it's always funny when you have friends from two different groups who then you're like, how did you guys meet?
Yeah,
like,
it's
how
true.
Did you guys get to know
each other? You know, it's such a boring story. By the way, it's not a boring marriage. It's great.
That's good.
But the way we met is
good.
So...
And Wonger with a same.
Love you, dear. No, but like, it's such a boring story that people say, so how did you meet? And it's just, we met at a party. I was with a friend and my friend goes, that's Rena Mahmood. She's really cute. I'll introduce you.
Right.
And the rest is history.
And then you were like,
smash cut.
I can show you the world.
I probably waited till the first date to drop that one. No, actually, it's funnier when she tells the story. But she kept like putting off our date. You know, I was just some dude she met at a party, and she was getting ready to go out with me one night, and she was at work. I think she was working on Gilmore Girls at the time, and somebody at Gilmore was like, "So who is this dude?" She's like, "He's a writer guy." She's like, "Well, let's Google him. Let's do our recon." And she's like, "I don't think he's very Googleable. I don't think there's any." Right? And so her friend Googled me, and she went, "Holy shit, we hit the Google mother load."
Scott Wanger, for those of you who don't know, the voice of Aladdin.
Yeah, man.
Which was which now that people are hearing, they're like, "Holy shit!" And your voice has not changed since the early '90s.
You know, I think I've aged a little bit, but the character has aged with me. I still go in every once in a while. They'll call. They're like, "We're doing. There's a new parade at Disneyland Tokyo, and you need to be like, hey, everybody, whatever."
Oh, wow.
And video games. There's always new technology and new formats. And like, we did this super cool Kinect thing where it was like a tour of Disneyland where the characters interact with you.
Yeah.
And so I had to do all the recording for that. You know, in the old days when you would make like a toy. It would be, they press the button and Aladdin talks. So you'd say like one or two things and, here's your check and like, thanks for the 5 minutes of your time. Now it's so interactive, you have to record every possible response. So it takes a long time.
You got to slip a weird one in there like, you're the only one who can understand me. Like just freak the
kid out. You again.
you again. Too.
it's, I get a kick out of it. And it's funny that, all these years later, it's still such a big part of my life. All that. Am I too far away from the microphone?
You can hold it, yeah. If you want to take it out of the stand, though.
Just do this. It's the way to go.
Really? I
just
don't know. I feel
relax.
Like it'll, then it's going
to
get
knocked.
I like
to do this. I like to put the I like to rest
oh, I like
the thing,
that. I like that.
Right here
that's
on my,
good.
On my table.
Watch your coffee.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's nice.
Kinda nice.
I like this. So, yeah. But the Aladdin thing, that movie came out in 1992.
I remember.
Like, you weren't even born yet.
I was way born. And I was very much an adult and saw it
way born.
Several times. I was way born. That's the opposite of being stillborn. I was way born. So I was super born by then.
I was so born.
I was in like the 40th trimester by that point.
This isn't going to work. I'm just going to lean in.
But not only did I see that, I mean, that... My favorite Disney movie was Jungle Book originally,
mm-hmm.
but then when I saw Aladdin, because there was such the Robin Williams element of it and the writing and the jokes, it was a real comedy movie as opposed to like it's a family, there was that really it was a really strong and so as a 20-year-old 19-year-old. I fucking loved the shit out of that movie.
Yeah, it really did change. The funny thing is it had that sort of changed the way they make animated movies now with sort of huge celebrities. In the old days, they would just have auditions. And I think Robin Williams, the star power that he brought, like that people associated him with that character so strongly that after that, they were like, well, let's get Leonardo DiCaprio to do the voice of whatever. I feel like I was very fortunate that as just some kid on a sitcom, I was able to get that part before the era of hiring just like, megastars to do.
Because in 94, I auditioned for Hercules, which did not do as well as Aladdin. They did a Hercules.
I think it still did. Well, they had that was an amazing run. I mean, Disney, they keep having amazing
runs. It did okay. I mean, the guy that voiced Hercules is not going in for voice call. They're not like putting him in a parade. I haven't seen Hercules in the park in forever.
Yeah, but Aladdin
become an animated series after that though, right?
Yeah, Hercules. In fact, I did a couple episodes of that.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I think Aladdin made some appearances in the Hercules series, but
wait, timeline so doesn't
try
to get the
timeline. Try not to have any
sense.
No, it makes perfect sense.
The historical element just doesn't check out.
out longer.
Okay.
The only... wait, now the magic carpet can fly and go back in time?
Maybe that's not true. Maybe I'm just getting some other actors. I'm getting somebody else's residual checks.
You're trying to tell me that the genie, who you set free foolishly, could
still
somehow
work kick... we did so much Aladdin stuff. It's crazy. We did that, then we did there were two sequels, and then we did a series.
Well, yeah, because you did the series because you had Gilbert Gottfried, too, as the Iago.
Yeah. And we had Dan Castellaneta as the genie. So we had Homer was the genie.
There was a pretty great joke on Brooklyn Nine-Nine where Andy Samberg's character said he says something about like by Iago, and she was like, "Oh, I didn't know you were I didn't know you were a literature fan." He was like, "What are you talking about? I'm quoting the parrot from Aladdin." Like, so that still people do.
It is funny to be that it's to have lived long enough to see it become like an old classic. Now they're getting ready to re-release it.
It's coming out of the vault.
It's coming out of the vault. Blu-ray. I just got wined and dined by the Disney publicity people.
And 69.
They said that's in the if I play my cards right. And basically,
pass over an envelope.
You've wined me and dined me.
So you've been to Club 33. Have you been to Club 69? Have you been to Club 33?
Oh, yeah, lots of times.
Oh, you son of a bitch.
Lots of times.
Of course you are, of course.
It's really funny. I spent so much time. The funny thing is I spent a ton of time at Disneyland, but when I was a kid, I spent months at Disney World around the Aladdin era because we did. Not only did we do.
You had to do that Full House that was from
we
there.
We did the
for
two
no
episodes
reason.
That same
oh, yeah.
year.
For
exactly.
No reason.
We did a back to back Full House episodes there. So there was one year I spent like 2 months in Disney World, and they treat you really great. You know, Disney, they know how to make sure, you know, take care of you there. You know, it was an incredible experience. Like, they would have these, they call them plaids, guys in plaid that take mm-hmm. care of, you know, take you from place to place.
Yep.
And I was a teenager. And it was an incredible experience.
Right.
But I remember I was there so much that I was going to miss my college interviews. So I scheduled an interview in Orlando with some alumnus from a school. And one of the Disney people in plaid had to take me to my... I remember the guy was like, who the hell is this kid showing up with them?
Don't you worry about him.
You went to Harvard, didn't you?
Yeah.
You're a Harvard boy.
Class of 98.
Wow.
I know, it's crazy.
It is crazy. But you're...
Were you there during the Rivers years? Rivers Cuomo years?
Ish, but he was way too cool. Like, we didn't overlap.
Yeah.
You know, but he it was known that he was there. Yeah. Dude from Weezer is here.
Did you write for the Lampoon?
No, I did it. You know, the funny thing is, in retrospect, that was a poor choice to make, was to not do that, because I didn't know. At the time, I had no conception that my career was going to go in the TV writing direction. That really wasn't my ambition. I don't know what was my ambition. I just sort of wanted to keep doing what I was doing at the time. I had a weird college experience because I was still doing acting stuff, you know, and still doing the Aladdin cartoons. Finally, they found a studio in Boston where we would go record. But before that, I would be going to LA or going to New York. And then finally, we found a studio in Boston. But I was also working for Good Morning America. I was like a news correspondent the youth correspondent for Good Morning America. So they would send me all over the world, basically. If I would get a call on a Wednesday, like, we want you to do a story on young Americans in Prague. Can you be there on Friday? And I'd be like, absolutely. And I'd throw some stuff in a bag and go to Prague.
How'd you juggle that with school?
I was used to it from high school. You know?
Oh, okay.
Like, I was used to that sort of, you know, and there were plenty of times where I would take the red eye back to Boston and take my luggage with me straight to class.
Jesus.
But, you know, when you're a kid, you don't need much sleep, you know, and if you I don't think I would be able to survive that kind of schedule now, although you do. I feel like you're that busy right now.
It's a little crazy.
I feel like your empire is very time consuming.
No, the schedule is a little demanding, but then I also always remind myself, like, well, the alternative is, I mean, I remember what it was like to sit around, and everything I'm working on, it's not like I don't like any of it, so it's, you
it's
know,
fun.
It's just kind of getting through the occasional, like, I'm just, okay, you know, and just being mildly cranky because I'm tired.
20-minute power nap.
But it's not bad, 20-minute power naps. What did you major in?
I did English lit, mostly, and then I did a lot of, I got really into French, so I studied a lot of French.
I remember that. I remember being at a bar with you, and then you broke out French with someone. I was like, holy shit.
It's a good parlor trick. No, but it's it's like at a cocktail party. No, it was I went there when I was like 17 to Paris, I had no interest in it. This girlfriend of mine dragged me there kicking and screaming. I wanted to go to like sit on a beach somewhere. And I immediately, I just fell in love with the place. I was like, someday I'm going to live here and I'm going to speak the language. And so when I went to college, that was like priority number one, learn French. So I started taking French A, which wasn't easy. But then I ended up in France a lot for the Good Morning America stuff. And just like a couple of days there at a time would really help. It like gave me a little boost. So I was able to catch up.
So how would you welcome?
By the way, my French, I heard your podcast with Hilary Swank where she spoke French.
Yeah.
That was adorable. I don't think it's adorable when I do it.
No, it's really cool. So. Your French is really cool. Like, welcome. Let's say you're in Paris and you're gonna take people on a ride in the metro, and you're welcoming them to Good Morning America in Paris.
I don't know how you would say it.
That was a confusing premise to start with.
So you're in the subway.
You know, you hold come on. Up with your
so
own
you're broadcasting
test.
Live from the subway.
Here's a premise: you're Aladdin at Euro Disney.
Okay, fine.
I don't know how you would say like carpet. Let's go in French. Tapis, allons-y.
There you go. Done. Done. That was a lot better than being a correspondent on Good Morning America welcoming someone to the metro.
All right. So, but you know, sometimes I like the circuitous route, all right?
I like how practical it was.
All right.
People got to know where the metro is.
So what I would like you to do is tell Willard Scott, great job on wishing all those people happy
birthday. Yeah, exactly. Wish now, someone just turned 108.
And it's Tuesday. Go!
Did you do the French version of Aladdin? Did you dub it in French?
I used to joke with them that I could. And in fact, I ended up, when I was in college, I lived there for like 6 months. I was working on my thesis. I did like a semester abroad. But they needed me, so they would send me to a studio there. Wherever I was, they would find me, and a car would come and bring me to a studio wherever I was.
I'm going
to
tag you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Get in the car with Jacques. And so I recorded in France. And that was like my fantasy, that I would get that good that I could do that. But I never quite got that.
It wasn't quite there yet. Well, it sounded really good whenever I hear you rattle it off. It always sounded really good.
I try to keep up with it, because it really is a thing that you lose if you don't exercise. You know, your brain just doesn't. You just forgets. You know, like an appendage that you don't.
Should go talk to Roland, the guy you got coffee from.
I had this little fantasy that I was like, if I worked on this lot, I'd speak French to Roland every day.
that'd be the perfect reason to get a job here and give up all of your TV writing, is just so you could be here and talk
to be with
him.
Bonjour, Roland. I have history with this lot. This was like one of my first exciting showbiz jobs was on this lot, because I came out here when I was to LA when I was a kid. I was like 13. Came out here with my mom to go on auditions and had a pretty uneventful summer. There wasn't a lot. Nobody told us summer really there isn't. Shows aren't in production. There's nothing really to do but hang out at Oakwood and, you know, go swimming. But in any case, I got literally on the way to the airport, auditioned for a commercial that shot here. It was this huge campaign. This is the Nerdist, so you guys are going to remember it. It was for the Amiga computer.
Of course.
And so we did a whole huge campaign with, there was the one where Stevie, the little boy genius on his computer, makes the house go up in the sky, lift up. And then there was one with all these celebrities, like the Pointer Sisters and it's on there. You could find it on YouTube. And so we did, and like all these celebrities come to my house, like Tommy Lasorda and the Pointer Sisters and Bert Bacharach.
Wow.
And astronauts like Buzz Aldrin came, and because he needed advice for the new space station on my Amiga. And so, but that was like,
kid, what do I do in space? No bullshit.
Yeah, it was literally like, I need help with Stevie with the new plans for the new space station. You know. I would do like Amiga commercial on YouTube or something. I'm sure it's there. I put it on Twitter one time.
Amiga commercial like Buzz Aldrin or just like
plug exactly. A couple names something like that.
And you know, the Pointer Sisters.
The Pointer Sisters. It was really funny. The premise was that this kid is so he's basically Leonardo da Vinci thanks to his Amiga computer. And like anything you need help with, he can come to your house and help you with. And so we did one where there's the house lifts, the celebrities come. What was the? Oh, there was another one where I tricked the girl next door into thinking I'm winning a Grammy or something like
what?
That. Yeah, it's like the best new artist of the year is Stevie. Whatever.
What did you hack the Grammys?
So, I hacked her house. There was a cable going from my computer to her TV, so we were able to put the graphics up on her screen and make her think that I was really winning
the award.
There was a, there, I'm sure there were a lot of disappointed kids who didn't really understand networks at that point.
Yeah, exactly.
That didn't understand how.
Well, sounds like you wrote that commercial.
It really sounds
French Metro Good Morning America.
All right. Yeah.
It was, but that,
we remember that that's what happened. Yeah. We remember that it was a bad.
If you, I think that's why they went out of business, because when kids realized you couldn't make your house levitate.
Yeah. House does not actually levitate. When did you get on Full House?
Full House, that was I did an episode once. They brought me on to be like DJ's hunky teenage boy date, and it was like one episode, and then the next season they hired me to be. By the way, I could refer to myself as hunky because that was 25 years ago, and I don't think I'm that hunky anymore. I'm like a gray haired dad, and then the following year they brought me on as a regular. So I did two seasons as a regular, and then I came back for the finale. I think I did about 50 total episodes.
Are you popping into the?
They asked me to.
Gotta do it.
Yeah, so I said I'd be happy to.
I was hoping you were the one that died.
Me? Well, you know that. By the way, I was always like, I always thought if I was ever going to reboot Full House, I'd make Steve's dead, DJ's a widow, and she and Gibbler and Stephanie have to raise the kids. It makes perfect sense.
That makes perfect sense.
And then they actually did that, but fortunately, she didn't marry me. She married some other dead guy. And so I get to live. Nice.
Oh, maybe you get to come back. Interest.
No, maybe he comes back as like a Jesse character. You know, but he's like the ex-boyfriend, so it's kind of sad.
You know, it'd be really amazing if I had the rights to something like Full House, I would start it off as a sitcom, and then there would be a trail of bodies all around DJ, and then it would be this like weird, like psychological. Yes. Serial killer, like this thing just humming in the background that pays off like after a couple seasons.
Interesting. She's like the Black Widow kid.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, that's it. That's my mom.
Aren't you astronauts?
Yes, ma'am. We'd like to compare notes with Stevie on the new space station.
Hi.
Hey.
We're the Pointer Sisters.
We need Stevie's help with our new album.
The Amiga computer. What can it do?
Well, what do you want it to do?
I need some more help.
Mr. O'Neill is upstairs for storage.
Mr.
O'Neill. Amiga from Commodore, the computer for the creative mind.
That's so funny. Wow. That was the short version. We did a long one where you actually see me like yelling at Tommy Lasorda. No, you got to put him on third, whatever. You know?
Who the other actor? There was the
mom and dad.
Yeah.
It's funny. I don't.
But
remember
that guy.
Names.
That guy's a famous character actor.
He does a lot. They both work a ton.
I think he.
Doogie Howser.
No.
Looked like you might have been in it.
I feel like he just just pass away.
I think you know, now that commercial, I think the people are starting to drop like flies from that commercial.
The curse of the Amiga commercial.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
we're all very well aware.
It's going to pay off in several decades.
Exactly. The curse.
They're
all going to live another 30 years.
You found the long one? Okay, good. Long
like
version.
Real Goonies.
47,000 views.
That's
Wanger.
Crazy.
Only four people don't like it.
Aren't you astronauts?
Buzz Aldrin,
Gordon Cooper,
Scott Carpenter.
We like to compare notes with Stevie on the new space station.
Oh, that hair.
Hi, Tommy Lasorda for Stevie.
Hey, what's up?
Just a question about moving Randolph to the number two position.
Yeah, second, and this will work. It's perfect.
Hi.
Hey,
we're the Pointer Sisters.
Stevie's expecting us.
Well, come in.
We need help with our new album.
Bert Bacharach, literature.
The Amiga. Color, sound, graphics, power. At a price to make it truly the computer for the creative mind.
Can you hear me, Stevie?
What can the Amiga do? Well, what do you want it to do?
Mr. O'Neill, Stevie is upstairs, but it's kind of crowded. Would you like some fried chicken while you're waiting?
Amiga from Commodore.
Yeah, it was weird before to just have Tip O'Neill short with a chicken leg.
But all of your brains didn't question it. You're just like, Tip O'Neill would have chicken.
In the abbreviated version, they just thought before the Speaker of the House brought over chicken. I had an amazing. I met, so I was freaking out because, you know, some of those celebrities, you know, I was a 13-year-old kid, so some of them, I wasn't that excited. My mom was very excited, and then some of them I was blown away, but one day Buzz Aldrin came into the school trailer to go to the bathroom, and I was like, this is my moment with Buzz Aldrin. And I was like, Mr. Aldrin, when you look at the moon at night, how does it feel to think I walked there? He like waited a beat and went, good. And that was it. I didn't catch him on a chatty day.
Fair.
Jeez.
Right, wow. But it was, that's exactly what I would probably say. It feels like, how do you describe walking on the freaking moon?
Yeah.
You know? So.
Do you think good. I thought it was interesting that they were upset that the Olsen twins are not going to be on Full House, the reboot. But what's puzzling about it is, how would that have worked? Would they swap one out every other
scene?
Yeah,
they would just trade them when one got tired or something. Yeah. I mean, because that's
or
no point.
She never recovered from that horse accident. Well, the finale, there's two Michelles.
Gotcha.
In the horse.
Yeah. Oh, so, yeah.
Yeah.
So, God, I forgot about it. But, yeah, the reason why there are twins is because when you hire very little kids, they can work very limited hours.
Of course,
hours.
Yeah.
So, but, yeah, then what do you do when they're 30 years old or whatever? I don't know. But I don't know how this whole thing came together. All I know is that they were like, we're doing this. Are you interested? And I said, yeah, that sounds like fun.
Did you record a lot with Robin on Aladdin, or did you record separately?
We both. We did a little bit of both. In fact, he improvised a lot. You know, there's a lot of solitary recording time on these animated movies, you know, hours and hours of every line said a million ways, and then weird sounds like, now you're hanging from a cliff, now someone's stepping on your fingers and it hurts, and you're almost gonna fall, you know, and you have to make all these forever. But in the beginning, everybody records together like an old, like a radio show, and then but with Robin, he would improvise a lot, so you couldn't just read dialogue to match up with his. You'd have to sort of respond. So we did some recording together, and in fact I used to I started to tell this story at the press junket, like, oh, that he was so funny one day in the room, I fell down laughing because I thought, I guess it must have happened. But I told the story so many times over the years that I was like, I don't remember that happening. I remember the story, but now I've told it so many times and it was so long ago, I don't remember if that's a true story.
Oh, wow.
And then might have just been something I said at the press junket one day.
You lying piece of shit.
But then the DVD came out however many years ago, and in the extras, it's on film. They caught it, me falling down on the floor.
So it actually did happen.
I was like, holy crap, I wasn't lying.
They actually,
so you really were ROTFLOL.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
They actually got Pixar. They got Pixar to do that, to cover, to cover your ass.
Just so that I was. Yeah, thanks, guys.
They used an Amiga.
You could do anything on that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this was, of course, before really everyone had access to the internet, but you somehow, with your Amiga, were networked that you could.
I was able to do it. Well, that's like, I'm watching that show, The Americans, where this, like, what do they call it, the ARPNet or something?
ARPA.
ARPANET.
Yeah.
And they're like, what do you mean the computers can talk to each other? It's fun watching that.
Yeah, yeah, ARPA was what ultimately became the internet was just a research project to try to...
So that people could communicate.
When I was
a freshman in college, that was the first year that they connected all the dorms to the internet. And it wasn't even in the walls. There were all these, every dorm had like blue wires hanging from the walls. And it was very exciting.
Well, did you ever use your Aladdin cred to kiss a girl?
No. You know, and it's funny because I...
All right, finger a girl.
No, Matt, come on.
Come on, Matt. Come on. Yeah, sure. Yes, yeah, yes. Definitely. No, not kiss, though.
You offered to rub their lamp.
I never, you know, it's so funny. Now that I don't think of myself as like a celebrity in any, you know, like I just go to work every day. Like I write on TV shows and I don't do the act. In fact, this is the first, I don't remember... This is really weird for me, even doing this. Like, I don't really do any
interviews
and stuff. Like, I hope I'm doing all right. I'm enjoying it.
It's going very well. So
but
far.
But I never, like, back in the day when I was doing it all the time and it was a normal thing to, you know, I was always a girlfriend guy. I was never like, hey, you ever heard of a little show called Full House? No, never. I have a crazy friend who's like, man, what's wrong with you? He goes, I've gotten laid because I know you. He's like, you don't take advantage of this.
Your friend's a creep.
Yeah, he's a creepy guy. I was like, maybe he goes around with a fez and tells everybody he's Aladdin.
Aladdin so. Entourage. It's basically just Entourage, but with all the Aladdin characters.
Yeah, and he's the star's not there.
He's not.
Yeah, I always enjoyed it. I always got a kick. I was very lucky. I had like a weird childhood because I would come out here and do all this acting stuff, and then I would go back to Florida to my, you know, to my regular school and have a normal life. In fact, I once went to... when I was first getting into TV writing, I went to Disney Channel and I was like, I got a great idea for a show. I pitched it. I was like, it's like the best of both worlds. He comes out here and he's famous, and then he goes home and he's just a normal kid. And they were like, they looked at each other. Are you aware we have this show called Hannah Montana? It's like literally that, like literally the song is, it's the best of both worlds. That's the song. I was like, oh, so, okay. Cause I got other ideas.
Yeah. It's called Seinfeld.
Yeah. He's a Jewish comedian.
The show's called Glorida, Florida. Her name's Glorida.
Yeah, exactly. Sure. Exactly. Glorida, Florida.
Sort of the ugly sister. Glorida. Glorida.
Glorida.
Glorida. When did you start writing for television? And how?
You know, I got into that. It's funny. I'm not kidding. It was never my ambition. And it's funny now because I've been doing it for a long time and it's kept me busy and I really love it. But at the time, I never took notice of the writers when I was a kid actor. Like for me, they would show up for the run-throughs and rehearsals and laugh really, really hard at their own jokes. And
sure.
And now I'm one of those guys. But I think the first time I got the idea to write a spec episode of a TV show was, remember when Bob Saget had that show on the WB?
Raising Dad,
exactly.
Staff writer and BJ Novak.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And I was like, oh, I'm gonna write me one of those. And because I was like, I've been to the tapings and he's my friend and I'm gonna write one. And I wrote one and it was really fun. Like they never made it or anything, you know, like they read it and they were like, oh, this is really good. Thanks. You know, that was
it. Yeah.
But like the idea of like putting it together and coming up with the act breaks and the story and the conflicts and everything. Like, I just really enjoyed it. So then I kept going and I really truly did start, you know, at the bottom. Like I went to work as an assistant to a director, like a very very busy, prolific TV director who liked my scrub spec. He's like, come be my assistant. I'm going to direct all these pilots. And one of the pilots that he directed, they hired me as their writer's assistant when it got picked up. And they gave me a script. They gave me an episode. And then that was sort of it.
What was that show?
That was a show called Like Family. It was another WB sitcom. Told unrelated, like just that was just a coincidence.
Which director? I wonder if I know.
The guy's name was Barnett Kelman, and he directed. He's sort of been around forever. He directed the pilots for Murphy Brown and Mad About You and Suddenly Susan, like hugely successful, prolific guy. Now he's like, I think he started the TV comedy department at USC, so he's like sort of a professor is his full time job now. But I was literally, it was a really weird situation because I was heating up. He was on the Zone diet, and he'd be like, find a microwave and microwave this for me. And I'd like walk into a casting office and they'd be like, hey Scott, are you here for the audition? I was like, no, I just gotta microwave this food.
I'm a writer, I gotta microwave this food.
Yeah, exactly. But like it was really weird because then I would some of the pilots, none of the people were known. I was the only relatively like known person on the floor of the show, so I'd be literally like handing out copies of scripts and then signing autographs for people in the stands. And it was a very awkward, really weird, you know, it was a very like I had to check my ego at the door to really do it. But you know, I'm glad I did it because I feel like there, you know, as a kid, as somebody who had done a lot of acting and had, you know, I think it helped me get taken seriously and also learn writer's room dynamics, which is like you can't just walk in knowing how a room works and what to do and not to do. It's like, it's something you have to learn.
You want
to,
by the way, if you can direct a pilot that gets picked up to series for a while, that is the fucking golden egg because you get paid
forever. Yeah.
If you pick up, like if you directed, like you know, you direct Cheers, Jim Burrows. Jimmy Burrows directs Cheers and he gets paid for every episode of Cheers that gets made.
He also did the pilot to Frasier.
Yep.
Barnett has a very large house. That's a good gig. TV directing, it's funny. That was another thing as a kid. I thought, maybe I'm going to be a director. And it's funny, I never really pursued that. Writing was something that, and once I got into it, and it was really funny because when I was in that first room, I was the writer's assistant in the room. So it was my job to sort of keep everything, take notes and keep it all organized, you know. And, so I wasn't like one of the guys and, you know, I wasn't one of the writers, but it immediately felt like, oh, like these are my people. Like this is what I should have been doing all this time. Because, you know, I came out of college and I was kind of tired. I had been working since I was 8. And I was like not up for the next like adventure or whatever. I just felt like, you know, I was dating this girl and her dad said to me one day after like I'd been out of college for a while. He's like, so Scott, how are you enjoying your retirement? Like, oh, shit. I got to figure something out. And so, and then, you know.
Pretty good. I'm nailing your daughter. Don't ever talk to me again.
And it's been a long time now. I mean, I've written for a lot of shows. And it occurred to me the other day that I've probably produced more episodes of television than I ever acted in.
Oh,
which is like a weird milestone. because, you know, it's definitely been more of a longer, I've been a writer way longer than I was ever an actor.
And so how is the dynamic between, basically your wife is also a very successful writer, so how do you balance the dynamic between writer couple?
It's great. Well, first of all, it's great because the problems that come along with being a TV writer, like the stuff that you come home and want to complain about to another person who's not a TV writer, we relate to each other on that level, you know, but it's great. You know, I briefly went into writing dramas. She's a drama writer mostly. Mm-hmm. She's very, very funny. She started in comedy on your show, but then she segued into writing, you know, all the classic like WB shows like Dawson's Creek, and she ran Everwood and shows like, you know, those sort of beloved from that sort of golden age of the WB. And she, and I've been mostly in sitcoms, but you know, but the truth is that being married to another writer is very good. I love bouncing. We bounce ideas off each other. I was going to make that joke. I heard Danny DeVito once when he was on a show, back in the day when he was married to Rhea Perlman, and they said, so what show was it? Why am I segueing into this? But I was like 11 years old and I thought it was the funniest joke ever. He said, when you're trying to decide to pick a role, Danny, do you run it by Rhea? And he says, yeah. You know, someone gives me a good script that I really like. I go home and I lay it on her and then I let her read the script.
Yay.
And of course I was 11. That killed me. Best joke ever. I was like, lay it on her. That means it. That means doing it. So, but being married to a writer is fun. It's fun because we can relate to it. Although she's been doing it, you know, she had the exact opposite experience of me because I came out of college and I didn't know what I was going to do. I thought maybe they would hand me my starring role in a sitcom at the airport, but they didn't do that. And I had to figure it out. But like, she literally graduated from college, drove to like the UCLA office for jobs to the job board, and immediately started working at like age, you know, like immediately, like crazy. Knew what she wanted to do. Like people who sort of know exactly what they want to do in life, I'm so jealous of, because it's like, it's sort of smooth, you know. But like, there's a quote, like, life is very, it's much more successfully viewed from like a single window. And
it's hard for most people to even know what they want to do. And I think that's, I think, you know, when you say like, what is it that you want? People are like, I don't know, just more of something. But, but it's very difficult for them to say like, this is the type of job that would make me happy and I want to do this. And I think if most people knew exactly what they wanted to do, it would be a lot easier.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, and it's funny because there were kids that I went to college with that knew, whether it was TV writing or some other thing, exactly what they wanted to do. And you know, they hit the ground running right out of college and they pursued that and they're very successful at it. And it's like, it's amazing. It's like I was so jealous of them because I truly didn't know exactly, after, you know, all those years being a kid actor, I didn't know exactly what I wanted. I got into Columbia Journalism School. I was going to go. I was made my deposit. I was ready to move. And I was like, I don't want to do this. Like, I chickened out. Like, I really didn't know. It took a while to sort of figure out my path. But now, I mean, I've been doing this TV writing thing now, you know, for more than 10 years. And I've written for a lot of shows, you know, and comedies and dramas. And I love it. You know, right now I'm working on a musical that I love. You know, musicals are one of those things where like I have zero musical talent, you know, but I love musicals. So I'm writing on this show now with that Alan Menken is writing all the music for.
But he did Aladdin.
Exactly. Yeah. So, but now he comes and we sit in the room and we come up with ideas for songs with him and the writing staff. And it's like incredible. You know, it's amazing. It's really fun.
But you sang in Aladdin. Yeah.
No, I don't want to break your heart, Chris, but I just talked.
Oh, you talked the song. That's
yeah,
right.
Yeah, I talked.
And then Peebo Bryson.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Peebo was my singing double. No, actually, I learned an important lesson as a kid. I went to an audition for this movie called Newsies, which is now a classic. Mm-hmm. And
yeah,
I love
classic.
It. Love Newsies. And I gave the audition of a lifetime. And they were like, that was great. That was perfect. You're perfect. Can you sing and dance? I was like, no. And I said, well, thanks. See you later. And then a buddy of mine got the part who couldn't sing and dance either, but he was smarter than me and said yes. And then they got Kenny Ortega, like the greatest choreographer in show business, to make him a dancer. You know?
If you had just said yes, you might have been Batman.
So exactly. Yeah. Had I only known, exactly.
You should have said, I can't dance, but please welcome the Pointer Sisters.
Yeah. Burt Bacharach, come in here and sing for it. But then I learned, I was like, I will never say no at another audition.
Let me just take
like,
20 minutes to set up my Amiga computer, which I've hauled in.
You can do anything. You know, they promised me
can I get
one
a grip over here? I need help.
You never get your Amiga?
You know, they said they were going to give me one, and they never gave me one. So I was like, for a long time, I was expecting it to show up in
the
mail.
You should get your Amiga to get another Amiga, and then you know what happens? You wish for an infinite Amigas. That's how that works.
And then you just have Amigas.
Yeah, the Amiga
forever.
Just replaces the Genie construct. So,
yeah, exactly. No wishing for more Amigas.
What? You're not allowed to wish for infinite wishes?
I think one of the rules, there were some rules. You can't make anybody fall in love.
Right.
You can't kill anybody.
Right.
Because then the movie would just be over. Kill that guy and make her fall in love with me, and give me a million more wishes. No, and you couldn't wish for more wishes.
You couldn't wish for more wishes. Yeah, those are the three rules.
Yeah, you know, listen, you can't.
Couldn't you just say I wish for the rules to not be in place anymore? But there was no restriction on not wishing.
I wish for those to not be rules. Right. Yeah, that's actually, you know, I think Aladdin. I guess you could have tried
genie
to get
loopholes.
There were a couple of moments where he tricked the genie into giving him a wish. Like he's like, instead of wishing to get out of that cave, he's like, I bet you can't even get us out of the cave. And then they get out of it. He's like, oh yeah, and he gets him out, but it doesn't really count as a wish.
I know, but I feel like that's violating genie code, right? How was he allowed to do that without it being an official wish? This is what I really want to break down and discuss today.
Yeah, exactly. Let's really get into it.
I have a complicated chart here and with the genie, a lot of answers that I really want.
The wishing system. It's funny, that movie, it really holds up. Like, I have a kid and I keep trying to get him to watch it and he's just not interested.
How old is he?
He's 5 and a half.
He'll get. I feel like
the and a half
there.
Is very important.
I feel like he'll get there.
Definitely. That's why I'm not pressuring him. I'm not pushing it. You know, it's like I've showed him like clips on YouTube.
Fire up the fucking Sega game. He'll love it.
Yeah, we had a weird like moment. Yeah, that's a good idea. Yeah. He's not into the video game so much yet. He's so little.
He loves Better Call Saul. So,
he loves.
He's like video games or cartoons.
Yeah, he likes Breaking Bad. But he loves cartoons. But he's just not into like daddy's. Like yesterday, we were at a pizza place, and it was one of those pizza places with TVs everywhere, and every TV. He had me on TV, and we never watch Full House at home. But I was like, "Hey, man, look up there. What do you think?" And he like looked at me, and he looked back at the TV, and he said, "That's you." And then that was it. Like that was it. You know. And then on the way to school this morning, I was like, "You know, that's like weird, right? That not everybody's mommy and daddy was on TV." And he's like, "Yeah, I know." I don't know what he knows.
Unimpressed kid.
You're the
school.
One who took me to Shakey's.
Yeah.
Unimpressed kid is a great meme. Just like
Unimpressed kid.
Hey, yeah, I know. Yeah,
well,
yeah.
It's true. You can't impress a kid. Well, because they don't know what's impressive or not. You know, that's like somebody told me. They were like, you could never take a little kid to a magic show because they never know what's the magic part. Like, what's violating the laws of the universe. You know what I mean? They don't know.
Teach them the laws of the universe first so that then they can watch
exactly.
Them
they haven't been around long enough to know. Like, for all they know, rabbits just live in hats.
As far as they're concerned, when the blanket goes over their head, the world disappears.
It does. Yeah, maybe.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, it's weird. It's a very weird thing to have in your past. It's very unusual. My wife makes fun of me all the time, like that. She claims I didn't have a childhood. I think I did, and I wouldn't change it. It was unusual and weird, and I emerged from it like relatively normal.
Yeah, you seem okay.
Normal-ish.
Yeah.
Normal adjacent. You know.
You got you got to get a good regular job, and you're still doing. But you're doing something that you love, and
it's really fun. It's true. I have to say, it's really. People make fun of me because I'll tell a story. I'm like, we'll be on a lot, and I'm like, I worked on this lot, you know, like 25 years ago, and they're like, oh, Jesus. Like, but it never gets old. Like, I have to say, we were shooting an episode. I was writing on Black-ish last year after Gallivant was a short season, so then I went over to Black-ish for the rest of the season, and we were shooting right outside of the studio where we recorded Aladdin. And it all sort of came together for me. I was like, this is really weird. I've been doing this a long time. But it's fun. Like, I never get bored with it. I love it. You know, I don't want to quit or retire. I just want to keep going.
And like I said, you could be Aladdin forever. Your voice is exactly the same.
Yeah. Listen, I'm going to keep doing it. As long as they call me, I'm going to do it. You know, it's really fun. And in fact, last year I was working in the building where they have there's a department called Disney Character Voices. And you would walk in there and there's a picture of me on the wall. And it's funny because it's totally removed from my writing career, but it's fun that it's like sort of there. It's like this thing that I do sometimes that has nothing to do with my life right now, but sometimes it does.
You know? Well, you're kind of Disney royalty in a weird sort of way.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. You know, it's funny. They have this thing called Disney Legends, you know, where they make you a legend. If you've like contributed significantly to the company, you become like a Disney legend. And they have this garden of legends with all these plaques on the wall and handprints and stuff. So they must have like this big ceremony somewhere. And I was walking there last year, and I saw that they had Linda Larkin, who's the voice of Princess Jasmine, up there with this big empty space next to her. I was like, wait a minute, what's what's happening? What are, like, I started to feel like Rodney Dangerfield. You know, it was really, yeah. I was like, what's going on? They've got Jasmine up here. And, but I said, but clearly they're reserving the space for me. So I'd walk to the Starbucks on the lot and stroll around. And I would, that would be sort of my daily exercise when I was working on, because I've been on the Disney lot for a few years now in different shows. And I walked by and I would be like, there's my spot waiting for me.
Shit.
And then I walked by there the other day and they put Dick Clark there.
What?
I know. I don't know. I don't know what's going to, I don't know.
Also the fact that they had to dig him up to get his handprints.
They just, well, he probably contributed more to like Hanna-Barbera than he did to Disney.
It's true. I don't know. I was like, there was, and I emailed.
They could have just put his hands up there, his actual hands. But I feel like you got trumped because Disney princess. Disney princesses,
you know, I think that's
literally royalty.
Oh, yeah. I did not know that. I didn't know because, you know, I have a son. I don't have a daughter, so like I didn't know the Disney princess thing is gigantic.
It's rabid.
Oh my gosh, she works way more than me. She's always doing like the princess videos and princess movies or like, you know, the kid shows where like one princess goes and hangs out with all the other princesses.
Did they stay together, Aladdin and Jasmine? Did they totally stay?
Because they got married. I think they have a kid in like the final, in this final sequel, the one that Robin Williams came back for, Aladdin and the King of Thieves. Was like the final, you know, they get together. I haven't watched it in a long time. But I think
and it wasn't like now, it's just she's yelling at him because she can't find her bejeweled iPhone and getting a white Mercedes and driving an Americana.
No,
Shawshank Sunset?
What?
Yeah, basically.
But yeah, it's funny. I wonder how old, I don't know how old Aladdin is now. If they were going to make a new one now that was sort of like part of that thing, I don't know. If it wasn't like a prequel or something, it was like today. No. I don't know. I guess he would be, I don't know. I don't know.
Well, he was probably what, like 16, 17?
When the movie came out, yeah, he was like my age. He was 17. I was 17. He was 17. Because like I think they adjusted it. You know, he started off younger and then got older. They kept changing the cast. Like,
so now he'd be 40.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Aladdin's 40.
Aladdin would be 40.
He's driving like a Porsche, and he has a lot of anxiety about like being middle aged.
It's an older Porsche that he bought from his first writing job. And,
yeah. No, I don't have a Porsche. I'm just saying that's like the middle aged. Like that's like the thing.
Yeah, we're saying Aladdin would have a Porsche.
He'd be having like a total midlife crisis.
I can show you the world, but we could just go online and see the same thing.
Gene, I know you don't work for me anymore technically, but I need boners, man. I need
like,
my boner.
Listen, look, can you make my hair dark again? Can you bring me back to that? Can you give me that Aladdin hair? But there's nothing like that teenage hair. You know, people recognize me, but I don't have the Steve from Full House hair anymore.
Right.
I still have hair.
Yeah.
This is a radio thing. This is not. Don't be mistaken. But it does not look like a teenage. Like I'm on the varsity wrestling team.
Yeah, that was a nice. The Amiga commercial was a very nice helmet of hair.
It was really nice. Cool. It was lush.
It's almost like teenage hair is almost like Lego. A Lego minifig where it just like
it's just like this monolith that you put on.
It's perfect.
I always see like little adorable Mexican kid baby, like the babies of the Mexican neighbors I have.
Yeah,
they have two babies and their hair is just fucking like a Lego head, just dropped it on there.
It's amazing.
My hair was such like a black monolith of hair. Like it was an incredible head of hair. But on screen, it looked like that. It looked just like I had a cat on my head or something. So I remember on Full House, they would send me to somebody to put like streaks in the front. Because you could sort of see that it wasn't like a Lego thing on my head.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, because it actually was a phenomenon that started because my zit medicine when I was a teenager would accidentally dye the front of my hair. Like, I would put on my zit cream at night and wake up and have little blonde streaks in the front. And then I stopped using that. I must have switched to a different brand. And they were like, what happened? Your hair looks different. And then they started sending me to somebody to put blonde streaks
that's
in my
hair. So fucking weird.
Yeah. Like, that's the kind of story I tell my wife. And she's like, your childhood was so fucking weird. Yeah. You did not have a childhood. It's great. And I always say I had one. It was just weird.
It just involved zit cream, which all kids have to deal with.
Exactly.
But then you had to have streaks put in your hair.
When
you stopped using the zit cream. Yeah. And it worked. Your skin looks amazing.
Thank you so much.
So it totally
thanks a lot.
Fine.
You know, I'm very clammy. You know, I have to admit, I'm a little, like, this is not a normal, like, I don't do, you know, it's weird. I used to go on national, when I was doing Good Morning America, I'd be on live TV, like, you know, thank you, Charlie Gibson, and, you know, like talking.
Don't you mean you were like, thank you, welcome to the Metro?
Yeah. Bonjour, Metro. But now I still don't think
it was
why
worst.
I don't know why it's so funny to me.
You know why? Because I'll tell you why. Because it was what was the expression you used to use? Like it was a lot of
laying a lot of pipe.
It was a lot of pipe delay to get to just getting him to talk French.
Yeah. Okay. Here's the scenario.
But I'm just like the part of me that finds it so funny is the part of me that would be like eating breakfast, watching Good Morning America, going like, why the fuck is this guy just welcoming me to the goddamn subway?
I don't even know if I could welcome people to the subway anymore if I tried in French. I don't get to use it anymore. You know, there was a time I was on some show and it had like pretty regular hours, so I got like a French guy. I found a dude like online who would come and have lunch with me once a week and speak in French, and I would like pay him for like an hour to talk French to me. And
oh, wow. That's a prostitute.
And it was great. It was like, he was a and then we would have sex together.
Oh, right. I left that part out. Yeah.
No, but it was great. It's like my French was like, it was on fire, and then I haven't done that in a while, so now it's sort of getting rusty again. I gotta do
you
that.
Mean
no,
en fuego
on fuego. My French was on fuego. That's French.
That's the language you know.
I think that's
yeah, French.
Fuego.
You know what, I'm so glad that we're doing this, because I was driving in my car once listening to the podcast with you and Saget. The first one, because he's been on a couple times,
been on a couple times, yeah.
And it was like, it was so weird for me because we all used to hang out so much all the time.
Oh yeah.
And it was like being with you guys, like I was driving and you guys were in the back talking. Really weird.
Which would have been something that happened, because a lot we both needed designated drivers a lot.
That's true. That's true.
It was the way it would work is every night, almost every night for a period of time, at about 1 a.m. you get a call. It's Bobby Saget. Where are you? And then you go, well, I'm at Madison's. And you're like, I'll be right there. And we'd show up a lot of times with you, and then we would hit all the bars at. I mean, I'm glad we can laugh about it now. Because
how did you do that, though? You only had an hour to go.
Well, because, first of all, Saget.
They would stay open for him.
Saget had like a golden ticket face because he was Bob. And so, you know, whenever he would show up someplace, people would lose their minds. And so, yeah, places would stay open and like, we're going to shut the doors, but you guys can stay. And he'd be like, all right. And I felt like it got weird one night where we ended up back at after a bar, like at a fraternity house, and we were drunk. And I can laugh about it now because the rest of our lives didn't unfold that way.
Thank God.
But at the time, what the fuck were we
doing? It was
doing?
Crazy. Although, you know, listen, by the way, we were like in our 20s. What's Bob's excuse?
Well,
we were kids.
Bob didn't really have his 20s because he got married young and had three kids right
that's
away.
Exactly
so
right.
He didn't,
it's
you
true.
Know, and I realized that this year I am the age Bob was when I met him.
That's so funny.
That
occurred to me the other. He and I got together. We had dinner the other night. I guess it was a few weeks ago now, but it was like it feels like the other night. But basically, he had never met my kid before. So he came over to my house, met my kid, and we went to Musso's, and it was like exactly the same. Where you walk into a restaurant, and they freak out for him. They freak out like Elvis just entered. It's crazy what. He always says, it's amazing how famous I am. And I'm like, yeah. Okay. And it's true, though. It's crazy. But it was really weird. And it occurred to me, it's true, that like now, he's only 20 years older than me. So it's like now I've known him for more than 20 years. So it's like I'm older now than when he and I became buddies.
Math is so weird.
It's so bizarre. I mean, like that stuff freaks me out. But he, it's true. We would hang out. When I was a kid, we would go out. My wife's like, wait a minute. So hold on. Tell me the story again. You're 17 at the House of Blues in some secret room that nobody knows about, and it's nothing but movie stars. I'm like, this happened. I'm telling you. This happened. And I'm sorry.
You take her to the room. It's just a wall. No, it was here.
I was here.
You got to tear through the quilted wallpaper.
The password is Bob Saget. it was a weird childhood.
I remember driving down Santa Monica Boulevard – past Beverly Hills, being really drunk one night with Bob, and just flat out going, seriously, how much money did you make when you were doing Full House and Funniest Home Videos? And he was like, oh, I don't want to talk. And I go, please. And he told me, and it was pretty good.
He did all right. He did
good.
All right. Although, the real,
especially in those days.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. I feel like because the next. Full House was on this stage at Warner Brothers, and then the next show that took that stage was Friends, and thus began the era of making a gazillion dollars,
right?
Instead of just a bazillion dollars,
right?
You know, and yeah, and I think that I mean, not, you know, everybody did fine back then, but I feel like now it's like you're on a show and it does okay, like it doesn't get canned, and everybody gets crazy rich. It's crazy.
I mean, that's very rare. It's more rare now than it used to be. Like that era of
massive syndication.
Yeah, that era of Seinfeld, Drew Carey, Raymond, like all, Frasier, like all those were there. I mean, it's really only like Big Bang is the only sitcom I can think of. Maybe Modern Family, where people really get a fuck ton of
like $1 million a week.
Yeah, networks have really figured out how to sidestep a lot of that stuff. Like you used to have quotes, and a quote was, you know, well, you know, I'm just telling for the podcast audience that, you know, it's like, well, you worked for this much money on this show, so your next show you have to get at least that or a little bit more.
Yeah.
And the idea of quotes doesn't even really mean much anymore because networks are like, well, we're not paying. But, you know, this idea of how has the idea of pilot presentations affected writers? It's basically the way that networks have categorized getting people to do a pilot, but for way less money. They just say, oh, it's a presentation. Like, but it's a full fucking show.
Yeah,
like,
it takes just as much.
You're just calling
work.
It a presentation so you don't have to pay everyone
as
much.
It's true. Although, you know, it's funny. I feel like, I mean, just from it seems like I haven't seen too many presentations happening lately. Like, it feels like there have been a ton of pilots. They've been buying a lot of pilots and shooting a lot of pilots and, you know, not necessarily picking up that money, many things, but it feels like I had friends last year with two pilots, three pilots, you know, it was a crazy, it feels like they've been doing a lot of, it's a weird time for TV. It's a very, you know, I don't have to tell you, you're very like, you're way more media savvy than I am. But
no,
like,
but I don't work in, you work in sitcoms basically, you work in comedy. So what's the state?
Well,
of
the state to me feels like it's quite, you know, I'm knocking on wood as I say this, because it feels quite good. Like when I first, you know, I told you about all that hard work I had to do to sort of like earn my way into a writer's room and like bringing people coffee and, you know, all that stuff. And finally I got there.
Yeah,
and
you did a Scrubs spec. That means you went in at the shittiest time.
That's exactly right. There were no comedies. There were almost, they were going away.
Yeah.
And I had a conversation with because one of the producers of one of those shows was Warren Littlefield, and he said, there have not been so few comedies since before we did Cosby Show, which was sort of like, there was like another window in the early 80s where there were like two network comedies or something.
So that would have been like the year that NBC decided to throw Jay Leno on at 10 o'clock.
Yeah, it was like the early 2000s.
Yeah, yeah.
And basically, I, you know, my wife's a drama writer. She's like, dude, your career is just starting in TV writing. If you want to do this, you got to switch. You got to write drama because there's no more comedies. And that sort of helped me. That I segued into writing dramas. And then fortunately, then a few years, I did it for like five seasons, to the point where I was more a drama writer than a comedy writer at that point. But I was able to switch back because now comedies are back. There's a lot of them. And I was very, very lucky to, I didn't know if I was going to have to like, am I going to have to start all over again now that I want to go back to comedy? Am I going to have to go back to being a staff writer? Like, I didn't know what was going to happen. And I was very fortunate that I got, you know, it just worked out. I've been on several in a row now.
Great.
So yeah, knock on wood.
But and is it harder as a writer to work on something that you're not as enthused about than an actor? Like what are the
You know,
difference?
I have to say, like, I always got the being in a writer's room is so fun and such a weird day. It's like, you know, you really just like go and hang out with people and sort of schmooze all day, and then you'll work and it'll get intense and you'll break a story, and then the next hour spent making each other laugh, you know, because it's part of the process. You know, it's like anything creative, you can't just be like super focused all day because you'll burn out. There's a lot of, you know, telling embarrassing personal stories time. You know?
Unless you're the guy who writes Vikings on the History Channel. One guy.
Oh,
is
really?
That true?
Writes every episode.
Wow.
My God.
I hope that doesn't get out. I don't want people finding out that could be done. That's not good for any of us.
No, I need a big staff.
No, you need at least like 15 people in the room getting free lunch.
Vikings does it.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it's really fun. And I've worked on at this point so many different, I mean, I was a writer on 90210, the new one, you know, the WB, CW one for years. I wrote the 100th episode. That's a fun fact about me and my wife.
What happened
to the 100 episodes?
Yeah, more than 100. 100. Yeah, wow. But my wife wrote the 100th Dawson's, and I wrote the 100th 90210.
Did you tie them together in some ways? A love letter to Rena.
So yeah, I dedicated to Rena. No, I, you know, it was that was a weird gig. That was not something that I sort of envisioned for myself that I was going to be writing for a show like that. But it worked, and it was fun, and it was an amazing. I mean, for a TV writer to get on a show and be writing, sitting, going to the same place, same show for four seasons,
yeah,
is like doing 24 episodes a year. It was a great gig.
Yeah. I would imagine it's probably, and it probably wasn't like super heavy lifting. Right? I mean, it's not like, I mean, you know, if to be writing on a show like that is probably kind of fun because it's not. You're not like, it's not like Breaking Bad where you're like, how the fuck are we going to tie all this together?
Well, that is true, but it's weird. You would think that, but it's weirdly probably just as labor intensive to make a show like that because it's so soapy with so many storylines and a huge ensemble. So we would have these whiteboards filled with story.
Oh, of
but,
course.
You know, but it was a soap. So like you could end half the scenes with like half the acts with like somebody finding out that they're being cheated on or whatever. So like it would be like off Teddy reeling. You know, so,
I thought you were gonna say like, so you could end half the scenes with people finding out something.
Yeah, yeah. No, literally, it would be like, or the overhear was a big thing, or like the walking in on something.
Oh, they're walking by lockers and they hear two people.
Yeah, like,
open.
Yeah, like, yeah, exactly. And you know, we always used to joke because so many scenes ended with like off so and so reeling that we wanted to do a scene on a pier where someone was fishing, and because I don't. And then we could do off Teddy reeling.
Reeling!
So, but we never did it. We should have done it. But it was fun. It was a great education, you know, like for me, because there was so much story that like it became like story-breaking boot camp, you know. Like,
sure.
So now that I'm back in comedy where there's way less story, it's much easier. You know, like breaking a story is, like, has become second nature, you know, and it's really fun. And, you know, for a 20-minute episode of television, it's like way less heavy lifting now.
Yeah, and then how much are you, I mean, I guess in the fucking around in the room, you're probably breaking stories that way, right? If you're like, oh, this crazy thing happened. Yeah. Oh, you write that down.
Well, the show I'm on now, Gallivant, is so, well, Blackish is like, you know, anybody, you know, we were all of us have families, and it was family sitcoms, so it was like one of those grooms where you're like, you know, my kid stopped using a nightlight, and then he had a sleepover, and the other kid needs a nightlight, and it was a huge nightmare. You know, and this, you know, smash cut to an episode about like the twins. One wants the nightlight, one doesn't want the nightlight. You know what I mean? It was like that was
my kids couldn't reconcile the fact that I was Aladdin, and yeah,
that's the problem when you have a really weird life. Yeah, exactly. But the show I'm on now, Gallivant, it's sort of like a Monty Python-esque show. It's sort of like The Princess Bride meets Monty Python, mm-hmm, and it's a musical. So it's ridiculous. Like I don't want to like. I don't want to get like fired for spoilers, but we're doing a thing where like these it's going to be like a big number where it's going to be like the Sharks versus the Jets, but it's like the Dwarves versus the Giants, and they hate each other, and there's a whole song about, let me tell you how we hate Dwarves and here's why, and we hate Giants and here's, and then they finally come together to rumble and find out that they're exactly the same size. You know, like, it's like, it's like ridiculous that, you know, but they still hate each other. But
who's,
you know,
this for?
It's on ABC, believe it or not. It's a crazy
show. I do believe it because Once Upon a Time, of course I believe it.
Well, that's exactly right. They aired us. Well, Once Upon a Time has a mid-season sort of break,
mm-hmm,
and for about a month. So last year we only did 8 episodes, and they aired us back-to-back over a month during that break for the same audience. And then I don't know. Now we're going to do 10 episodes this season. I don't know where they're going to air us or what the plan might be. That we might be on during the Once Upon a Time break, or it might be a summer show. I don't know, but.
And you never have any desire when you're writing to like, I should just jump in front of the camera. I've done that a few times.
On What I Like About You, I came up with a character, and my boss goes, Happy Hanukkah, you be the character. And, and I was like, well, I wasn't really asking for that.
That's only one of the 8 nights.
Yeah, exactly. Well, but it ended up being a huge recurring, and then she gave me a bottle of scotch, and she gave me for the other 7. That was weird for me. That was sort of like the dream that I always had, that I'd be doing both, where I'd run to the stage to rehearse my scene and then run back to the room, you know. And that was like for the rest of that season. And then I did like on The Neighbors. I was on this show, The Neighbors. It was a weird show about aliens, like this.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it was a really great show. I love it and I miss it. But like in the season finale, me and Candace Cameron, who played DJ on
Yeah, Wild, of course. Yeah.
We like these humans were moving into the neighborhood, and we wrote me and her in as the humans.
That's
and
great.
So, and it was crazy. It got like tons of publicity, but then it didn't really save the show.
Well, would you want to work on a show that was kind of more like the style of like like, you know, The Office or Parks and Rec, where like a lot of the writers are also on camera more often?
Yeah, that would be incredible. I mean, for me, you know, it's funny. I don't pursue it. I feel like if that ever happens, that'll be one of those weird, fortunate things that happen. Yeah. But I don't pursue it at all. I don't know why. I feel like I never liked auditioning for things. I don't like – that was like my Achilles heel, and it's sort of a big one if you're an actor, is auditioning.
Yeah, it's the worst.
It's the worst. It's horrible. And it's a totally different skill set than like – acting.
Of course.
If they would just give me the part, I would be great. But the audition, you get nervous and you get inside your... The secret for me was not giving a shit about something. If I didn't think it was important and it had no leverage on me, I would nail it. So like those commercials, which helped me sort of get an agent into LA and sort of launch my whole career. Or like even Aladdin. It was just a cartoon. I had no idea it was a big deal. If someone like said... don't mess this up. This is going to be like this huge.
You're going to be doing this for like 25 years.
Yeah, I would have just been in a flop sweat. I would have been terrible. And, you know, but because it was my after work one day, I was on some sitcom and I had an audition after work for some cartoon. I couldn't care less, you know, and I nailed it for that reason. I'm never going to pursue acting as a career, but if it works out that way by accident, then I'll do it.
Nice.
Yeah.
God, you should pitch something weird with you as the anchor. You should be the writer performer. Yes, of course.
I don't know, man.
Something weird and creepy and dark.
They asked me. I don't have anything weird, creepy, or dark in the cards, but they did ask me to be on that new Full House thing. So I told them I would.
You could do that. Something on your. Have you ever worked with Rena on anything?
In fact, that's how I got into writing dramas. Nepotistically, she hired me on her drama because she was like, sitcoms are going away. You are on a sinking ship, my friend. Come write for 1 hour. I was like, you know anybody with one?
She's fun to watch a man sleeping his way in there, huh?
Yeah, exactly. I thought that was exactly.
Finally, a win for us.
Exactly. Well, the funny thing is, we weren't married at the time, but I was working on the show, but we were engaged. I think we got engaged around that time. And one of the editors, you know, like had a heart, like, was like, I can't believe Rena's like, cheating on her fiance with that writer on the show. Like, didn't know that was me.
That's when you have to play it up and pretend that you're doing something wrong in front of everyone else. So.
No, it was, you know, it was one of those things where, then you know.
You're real.
You can't. It's weird. You know, television is one of those things. Show business in general is one of those things where you should never have any shame about being nepotistically aided by somebody because everybody does it. And it's kind of the only way in. It's like a fortress and like getting through those walls. And so like getting into drama, you know, I was very fortunate that she sort of greased the wheels. I worked for her on this one show. And then it went away. And then, but because I had that experience, they hired me on 90210, which I ended up doing 100.
Well, I don't think, you know, this idea of nepotism is, it's something that people outside will whine about because they are being shitty and sad. It's like someone might be able to give you an opportunity, but you most of the time you have to put in the work and be good to keep a job. Like you can't. Mm-hmm. It's like the nepotism thing, unless it's like, oh, his father, owns the studio, and you have to like. The business doesn't just doesn't care who's related to whom.
That's absolutely true. I mean, like getting in the really it's all the only thing that nepotism could truly probably help you with is getting in the door,
getting an opportunity.
Yeah, exactly.
Which you could get an opportunity. I mean, you should any opportunity you can get, you should take.
I personally
then it's up to you to prove that you deserved it.
But don't you? I love helping my friend. You know, I mean,
of
like,
course.
Now that I'm in a position where I can help people, you know, people are like, "Would you read this or give this to so and so? Or is there any give me notes on this thing?" Or it's like my favorite thing to do. It feels so good and it's so easy.
The only thing that's weird is that is when people that you don't know are like, hey, read this and tell me what you think. You're like, you didn't even say please.
Yeah,
I don't know you.
There is a weird etiquette to it. Like, you should never email someone like, hey, can you read my script? And include the script. Because that's like, you should always be like, can I read the script? And then if they say yes, then you could send it along.
Well, this is another one that's been driving me crazy. And this actually isn't with those types of solicitations, but someone will cold email me about a service because of Nerdist. They'll go like, hey, you know, it seems like your website could use the type of traffic tracking that that my company provides. Mm-hmm. And then I don't answer. And a couple days later, just checking in to make sure you got that first email. And I finally, like, by this one guy, like the third time, I wrote back and I go, you are cold emailing me. If I don't write you back, do not keep poking me. Mm-hmm. Like, I got it. I don't want you to keep, like, I think that's such a bad, I think that type of persistence is a bad sales tactic because
it's annoying.
It is annoying.
Yeah, that is annoying.
Hey, you didn't ask me to email you this, and I'm trying to get you to help me out. Just making sure you... Yeah, I fucking got it.
Yeah, that's really funny. Yeah, I mean, I'm not in a situation really where, unless you have your own show, you can't really hire people. So I feel like, I always feel like that's the situation where there's a lot of pressure to help people out. You know, when you can actually... I have a friend who had a show that got canceled this year, and like he was most upset that like 200 people that worked for him lost their jobs. And
well, that's the shitty part is that you are.
I want to talk about your Apple.
You're responsible for you're responsible for a lot of people, that the decisions that you make affect more than just yourself.
Yeah,
and I think that can be awkward.
Yeah. Heavy is the head that wears the crown, which I don't wear, so it's okay.
Do you want your own, would you want your own show?
You know, I think I would. I would really like it. I think that you know, running. It's funny. That's why I have to say, my wife Rena, who I don't work for, just married to her, is an amazing showrunner, because she's like sort of like has all the skills that you need, which is she's a great writer, but also a great leader and a decision maker and a good delegator.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you need to be all of those things, and it, you know, it'd be a cool challenge, because I've seen situations where you get someone who's like an amazing writer and they get their show on the air and then they don't have any of those other things,
right?
And it goes really badly. So it's sort of you know, it's a huge challenge, you know, and also when you're on a show and you don't run it, you go home at the end of the day and you leave the show at home at work,
right.
You know. But if you're running it, it never ends. You know what I mean? Like, you're always approving wardrobe or whatever, or, you know, reading somebody else's outline or somebody else's script, and, you know, but I mean, I would love it. That's what I signed up for. So if it ever happens, I'll gladly do it. You know, I think it'd be really fun.
Is there anything you want to promote or plug or, you
well,
know,
listen, I hope everybody watches, Gallivant when it comes on. I don't know when it's coming on. But I hope you watch it, 'cause you're going to really love it. It's really fun.
I'll tell you what, if you wanted to persuade them even more, I think mm-hmm. you should do a line from Aladdin and then plug Gallivant.
Oh, God. Okay, hold on. In English? No, I'm just kidding.
Aladdin is in the Metro.
I'm a little stuffy today. I probably sound like Aladdin with a cold, but I don't remember any lines from Aladdin. Hold on. Wait, I got one.
Okay.
I have like my stock one, Beyond Carpet, Let's Go.
Okay.
Jasmine, I do love you, but I can't pretend to be something I'm not. Is that it? Is that right?
And then you're supposed to plug Gallivant.
So, watch Gallivant on ABC. It's fantastic. And by the way, the Aladdin Blu-ray is coming out, I think, on October 13th, 2015. So you should totally buy it.
Blue like the genie.
Pre-order that.
Pre-order that
before it goes back in the vault.
Yeah, because they will put it back in the vault. They'll just take it away from
you. It's true. You know, it's funny. It's really exciting because it goes away and then it comes back. Because whenever some new format thing, you know, it all of a sudden becomes like a big part of my life again, you know, talking about it. Maybe, you know, I'll come back and do this podcast again in like 20 years when it's like out on Bubble Chip. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, when we're doing it, on Bubble Chip.
Guys, pre-order it for only 40 Gleep Glarps.
Exactly. On Bubble Chip.
But this is really fun because I love your podcast and it was cool to be here. I can't imagine anybody but me and my mom are going to find this that exciting. but I love it.
Don't worry, there's a lot of moms out there.
There's moms, and then Rena's going to listen to it.
Rena's
going to
love it. I spoke very highly of her. Love you, honey.
I mean, you know, you started to talk about how boring it was to be in a marriage, but then you saved it at the
last. Oh, are we rolling?
No, God, what? Yeah. No, I'm kidding. Rena is wonderful and brilliant and
she's
awesome. And so please tell her I said hello.
You know, she's a huge... And when we lived, you used to drive by our house all the time.
All the time.
Because we lived on a busy corner in your neighborhood, and it was so fun for me to be like, hey, Chris, come over and meet my kid. Come on.
Technically your neighborhood, really. Our neighborhood.
Our neighborhood, yeah. Which is still our neighborhood. But, you know, but now we both don't live where we lived.
And
but,
your house was my favorite house on that street.
Can I tell you?
Your house was the most picturesque... Perfect little picket fence house.
I'm not kidding. We used to live a block away from that house and called it Favorite House. And one day I was driving by and there was a for sale sign outside that house. And I texted Rena, Favorite House is for sale. And that's why we lived in that house, because we bought Favorite House.
But then you sold Favorite House.
Then we sold Favorite House. You know, when you have a kid and stuff, there were things, you know, like it was like an amazing house. And I sold it to a friend of mine who was always like, I'll buy it.
Yeah.
You know, but like we needed a bigger backyard and stuff like that.
And a jail cell.
So, yeah. we needed a dungeon.
Yeah.
but love that neighborhood. We say it's still there. And you and I, we have to go get that coffee sometime at the neighborhood hipster coffee
joint.
We're
going to go down to hipster coffee.
We'll put on those what are those things called? Those Trilby's? Knit scarves that they wear.
Yeah, knit scarves and, we'll and a beret and walk down there. And yeah,
Cat talk about the old days hanging out at Madison's. I don't remember. You know the funny thing? I don't remember that place. I don't remember Madison's.
It's where we spent a lot of time.
By the way, that speaks to that time in my life that I don't remember.
Yeah. It was right on...
Which one was that?
It was right on... fuck, what was the name of the street? Broxton, maybe?
Oh, yeah. Oh, like by the UCLA campus.
It was right by UCLA campus. Yeah. So it's the street that bisects the two main movie theaters. In
yeah, totally. Boston, it was like kind of almost a walking street, right? Yeah. Yeah, totally.
The street from the Gypsy
by
Cafe.
By the parking lot.
Where we used to start, we used to do open mics at the Gypsy Cafe, right next to the Fox and the Broom Theater.
That leads to the Fox Theater.
Yeah.
Totally.
And then we'd go a lot of times, it was... you know, Saget would do a set at the Laugh Factory, and then we'd either go hang out at the Laugh Factory or go or hang out with him at the bar next to the Laugh Factory.
That was so fun, you know, because I'm not a comedian and I wasn't like part of like comedian culture. So like for me, going with you guys to like the club and hanging out and like, you know, complaining about life with a fellow comedian was so much fun. Like that was seeing people that ended up blowing up, becoming a huge comedian, you know, comics and performing in those tiny little
but
rooms.
Then of course he was also still hanging out with Norm Macdonald and Lovitz. And so they would just be at the table, and then I would always be too nervous to really say anything because I just didn't have any.
Yeah, it's true. Same thing. I remember he'd be like, "We're just going to pick up my friend Norm on the way," and I'd be like, "Norm, I know
McDonald's."
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, but for me, that was a lot of fun because I was more of a fan than a participant in that stand up stuff.
Well, I hope to see you on the Full House reboot as potentially another person that DJ murders
as her next victim.
Yeah, I mean, I think that'd be
that would
what
be amazing.
What if they found out it's Uncle Joey who's cutting the brakes in the cars? He doesn't have anywhere to live.
Listen, it could go that way. It's Netflix. It's not on a network. They could do anything.
I mean, the important thing is that there's no way she can afford to live in San Francisco.
I don't know. Are they going to put that set back up and she still lives in that house? Like, I feel like nostalgia is probably going to play a big part of that. I don't know. I don't know anything about what the plans are.
Gentrifying Oakland.
they had asked me. They said, "Do you want to come on and be one of the be part of the creative team?" And I thought, well, that would be sort of cool because it would unite my old career and my current career. But I mean, I was obligated to two other shows. Like, I couldn't ask. Like, I couldn't leave the other shows I was on. But it was kind of a neat. It was, first of all, it was hugely flattering that they asked, and like it would have been a cool opportunity. But I think they said, "Would you still come on and act on the show?" And I thought, I said absolutely. So check it out on Netflix.
I hope there's an urn on the mantelpiece with Comet in it.
No. I think Comet should still be alive,
but just like barely. Comet, like, they have to. They force it to stay alive with drugs, and it just wants to die.
Has hip dysplasia. Yeah. And they just keep pumping him full of cortisone.
And he's just dragging around Woody the Woodchuck with his new chew toy.
That's really funny. I wonder. I don't know. I don't know what it's. People are asking me like crazy out there. Twitter. They're all going nuts. You know, in the Twitter thing. You know, asking me. But I don't know. I don't know anything about the show.
All right.
Other than,
we'll come back when you do.
The only thing I know is that they asked middle-aged Steve to come back. By the way, my mom just moved in with her boyfriend and dumped all these boxes on me from her house, and I found Steve's jacket.
Oh shit!
In mint condition.
You still have to. You have to keep. Oh, you have to be
God,
wearing
I
it
hope
in the
still
show.
And you know, drives a Camaro. Let go, Steve.
He never grew up. Never. And by the way, my wife was like, "That's a cool jacket. I'll wear that jacket." I was like, "Honey, take care of this jacket. It's this should be like in the Smithsonian." She's
should
like,
"Be
a
Planet
no,
Hollywood.
It should. Yeah, exactly. Maybe a Planet Hollywood
in Reno."
So anyway, this is really fun, guys.
Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me. It was awesome.
And maybe we'll let you sign off the podcast this time.
I know what you say because I'm a big fan.
What?
Enjoy your burrito, everybody.
God damn it.
Hey.
He knows.
Bam!
On the Metro for Good Morning America.
Exactly. Au revoir.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
For more than two centuries, the White House has been the stage for some of the most dramatic scenes in American history. Inspired by the hit podcast American History Tellers, Wondery and William Morrow present the new book, The Hidden History of the White House. Each chapter will bring you inside the fierce power struggles, the world-altering decisions, and shocking scandals that have shaped our nation. You'll be there when the very foundations of the White House are laid in 1792, and you'll watch as the British burn it down in 1814. Then you'll hear the intimate conversations between FDR and Winston Churchill as they make plans to defeat Nazi forces in 1941. And you'll be in the Situation Room when President Barack Obama approves the raid to bring down the most infamous terrorist in American history. Pre-order The Hidden History of the White House now in hardcover or digital editions wherever you get your books.